Chapter 10. Assimilation. It is not the strongest or the most intelligent who will survive, but those who can best manage change. Charles Darwin. In the spring term, the high point of each medical school society's annual activities was a formal sit-down dinner in the house officers' quarters of the Doctor's Building at University College Hospital on the other side of Gower Street. That evening, wives and girlfriends, who were usually not permitted in the male domain, were tolerated. The Medical Society's banquet was an elegant, elaborate affair. Professor Young, resplendent in black tie, gave a short, witty speech, followed by one delivered by the student president. The impressive array of cutlery for the multi-course dinner and the variously shaped wine glasses that accompanied each dish intimidated me. I learned which of the multiple knives and forks to use by observing others and practiced the art of small talk. Such dinners in medical school were milestones in my social development. Raised in a Muslim household, there was no alcohol. Now, in England, I always faced the question of red or white. Additionally, since mother hated fish, she never bought, cooked, or ate it, so Gulnar and I adopted this culinary prejudice. I decided that as a potential member of the medical profession, I would learn to eat and drink the same way others did. I arranged a comparable feast on Friday, April 24th, 1964, for the Students' Physiology Society, courtesy of the Physiology Department. Professor Huxley, dressed in his grey suit, gave a solemn talk about the significance of his research on nerve conduction. As student chairman, I spoke next. Unaccustomed to public speaking and feeling somewhat embarrassed, I limited my comments to say, "The reason the lion did not eat Androcles after he removed the thorn from its paw is that he promised not to give an after-dinner speech." I sat down to wild applause and cheers that I attributed more to the free-flowing wine than to the eloquence of my comments. Despite my workload, I resumed rowing, sensitive to the University College's high-ranking position that placed us at the top of the various rowing teams competing for the annual Henley Royal Regatta. Despite my reluctance to jeopardize my academic advancement, I respected that my team members needed my physical strength to help cross the finish line and end the season. In the spring term, our achievement in beating the other London medical school teams and colleges during the heats and clocking the best time placed us in the top position. We would represent University of London at the annual 5-day Henley Royal Regatta held later that spring. On day one of the races, we suddenly learned that based on our timing during the fall trials, we were placed in the first lineup, head-to-head with Oxford University's team. In the eliminating races, the two boats approached the starting line, and as the clock and race began, we sped forth. With willpower, we kept the pressure, keeping pace with Oxford's crew, stroke by stroke. As we came around the bend of the river and the spectator marquee appeared, we entered a manic racing mode, dashing toward the finish. Grunts grew louder, farts flew further, and shit escaped our sphincters as we gave it more than our all. Then, in a burst of steroid-filled energy, unbelievably, Oxford pulled away and ahead of us, their grunts quieter and their farts fainter, more disciplined as a team bent on victory. Crossing the finish line, each man collapsed over his oar, gasping for breath and feeling utterly deflated and defeated, without a shred of charity toward the victors. I cursed them.